There are some valid points made about the relevance of the way RCTs are often done. We worry that we test things at a small scale, it's not going to be predictive of how they're going to perform at a larger scale.
Randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, have had a profound effect on research in developing countries. And more policy interventions are now evaluated this way. But this trend has been controversial. Critics argue that the experimental approach has drawbacks that make it less useful for policymaking than its practitioners, we could call them the randomistas, claim. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, a series of interviews with researchers and practitioners in the world of development. My name is Tim Phillips. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Kartik Muralidharan and Paul Niehaus from the University of California, San Diego. Kartik and Paul have many years of experience working on program evaluations in developing countries. They argue that the randomistas can answer their critics, and some are already doing this, by thinking bigger. In the title of a recent journal article that they wrote, they are experimenting at scale. Kartik and Paul, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
We conduct many more field experiments than we used to. Can you explain how they work and why they have become so important?
I think it's useful to take a little bit of a historical step back and, you know, go back to the 80s when people were writing papers with provocative titles like, let's take the con out of econometrics, or I just ran 2 million regressions. You were in a place where basically empirical results were incredibly unstable depending on what you chose to control for in your main regressions. The RCTs are part of a broader trend of what's been called the credibility revolution in economics, which just focuses on well-identified causal estimates of programs. And so what we mean by that is essentially just being able to cleanly have causal stories between policies or programs and their impacts. And there's many ways to do this. RCTs are not the only one, but certainly there's a class of questions for which RCTs are incredibly attractive as a very credible way of getting at causal effects. And so the basic idea is very simple. Let's just take an example from education, which is a sector I've done a lot of work in. So let's take the case of a school feeding program, which is a very widely recommended approach to improving education in developing countries. And the government of India spends close to, I would say, $10 billion a year on school feeding programs. And if you were the Minister of Finance coming to the Minister of Education and saying, we've spent all this money, can you tell me what the impact of this program has been? In practice, that's a really hard question. And most government officials are just not equipped to answer that question. And that's because even if you were to do a simple before and after comparison, there's many, many things changing at the same time. Incomes are changing, attitudes are changing, exposure to media is changing. And so it's just basic statistics of going back to the idea of a randomized clinical trial that you have a treatment group, a control group, and you basically get a clean estimate of what the impact of the program is. Now, I think the basic idea is not very new. It's been around for a long time. I think what's really changed in the last 20 years is kind of a recognition that in development economics that it's possible and particularly important to do more of these studies. So it's more possible to do experiments in developing countries mainly because the resource constraints are so much more severe that governments rarely have the resources to cover entire populations to begin with. And so in almost any major program, you will see that governments are phasing things out or that they're kind of choosing which areas to cover. And the same issues apply to nonprofits who are coming in with new programs. So basically, the moment you recognize that you're resource constrained and kind of can't be everywhere, it becomes very natural to say, can we actually use the setting to learn something about the effectiveness of the programs? And so how an RCT works in practice is you have researchers partnering with governments or nonprofits or other implementing partners who will then say, here's a program that we're interested in studying. We hope it's going to have an impact on outcome Y. And you work with them to say, okay, let's kind of have a staggered rollout where you have a treatment and a control group, you measure the outcomes you care about before and after, and over the course of this experiment, you can usually learn not just about whether the program is effective, but usually learn a lot more about the context and discipline your program design by evidence. So I think, that's broadly how they work. And I think why they're important, we can talk a lot more about this. I think they're important not just in the cases where you've found things that work, but also, in some ways even more important, are cases that are interventions that are very high profile and popular, but then where careful research shows that you, in fact, end up with no impact. And but just to give you one very striking contrast. We had this RCT in Indonesia where the government doubled teacher salaries across the board, an incredibly expensive policy that many education advocates thought would improve teacher motivation and improve teacher effectiveness. And we found basically zero impact of doing that on outcomes of students. In contrast, you have other interventions that are much more inexpensive, ranging from some school health interventions to other interventions about pedagogy that are a lot less expensive, but that seem to be getting you very large impacts. And so if you take a big picture, a view on all of this, the goal is to say, can we reallocate public and philanthropic funding from interventions and programs that are less effective to those that are more effective, and thereby use the evidence to improve the effectiveness of public and philanthropic spending in development?
Nevertheless, there has been criticism of RCTs because the positive results in the trials sometimes don't show up when the experiments turn into policies. Why not?
Tim, there'll always be some pushback when things change in a big way, regardless, even if the change is largely for the better. But I also think in this case, there are some valid points made about the relevance of the way RCTs are often done. So we worry that we tend to gravitate towards working with partners, working in places where the results may not be representative. Hunt Alcott has a nice paper showing this in the context of energy conservation measures, where the first round of experiments that were done in places where the treatment effects turned out to be bigger than the places that were subsequently tested. We worry that we test things at a small scale, it's not going to be predictive of how they're going to perform at a larger scale. I think Karthik and I take this very seriously because of the work that we do. We work with governments who are struggling to do the very basic things like giving people food at a large scale. And often it's specifically about the contrast between things that are implemented by an NGO in a pilot study and by a government at scale. So Tessa Bold and co-authors have a nice result in Kenya where they show this. They show that when an NGO scaled up a pilot, they got the same result. When the government scaled it up, it had no effect at all for complex and interesting reasons. And then we worry that RCTs may pick up the initial effects that an intervention has on behavior, but aren't going to tell us how those behavioral changes would then translate into effects on market equilibrium or political equilibrium. And I think this is very much the point that Daron Acemoglu made in his argument for the role that theory should be playing in development economics. So there are plenty of legitimate reasons to question the practice of simply saying, because I've done an experiment, I got the right answer.
Already we're throwing around words like big and scale. When we're talking about a small experiment or a big experiment in your world, what does that mean?
Yes, I think, you know, this is clearly a continuum. There isn't necessarily some arbitrary cutoff below which something is small and above which it's big. But I think it is useful to characterize scale on three broad dimensions. I think the first concern about experiments is that these are done in non-representative samples of self-selected participants. And so there's a question of how representative is the population in which your study is done. There's a second way in which scale matters, which is what is the scale at which your intervention was implemented. And this is not so much about government versus nonprofit. It's just that doing things at scale is inherently more complex. And so you might often get very promising results from studies that are implemented at a very small scale, which is just easier to implement. And then there's the third way in which scale matters, which is the size of the units of randomization, which matters to the extent that you want to capture spillover effects and general equilibrium effects. And so those are three very concrete ways we think about scale.
Let's dig into that in a little bit more detail. In your paper, you looked at some RCTs, and I think the median size for these was that they involved about 10,000 people. People would be very surprised to find out that a sample size of 10,000 isn't big enough.
Well, Tim, just to be clear, 10,000 is the median sample frame. What that's saying is that the median study in this set we looked at, and these were studies that have been impact evaluations published in top journals in the last some number of years, we're sure that the answer was relevant for a population of 10,000 people. That's what that figure means. Now, of course, the results may generalize to larger populations, but I think what we're saying in the paper is, wouldn't it be nice if we designed our experiments in a way that we could be sure of that, right? And we can't be for sure, right? Because, you know, even with a sample of 10,000 people, if we took them all from London, Tim, let's say, that wouldn't guarantee that we're learning the right answer for the rural parts of England, for example.
So if, however, you go for a much bigger scale, does that mean you inevitably have to do these experiments by working with governments rather than with nonprofits?
So I think it's more often the case that you will work with governments when you're doing things at that scale, but it doesn't have to be the case. So there's very large nonprofits like Pratham working on education in India, BRAC working on a series of anti-poverty programs in Bangladesh and other parts of the world. So I think, you know, the margins in which we're talking about scale is you could, in principle, be a nonprofit and still choose to work in, say, a random sample of villages drawn from across Bangladesh, which would then make your experimental estimates relevant to a population of close to 150, 200 million people. So I think it's not so much about this that you have to be the government. It's do you choose to be in a representative sample? And there's a lot of nonprofits that aspire to scale that would, in fact, tick that box.
Doesn't working at a larger scale just mean that fewer evaluations are going to be done? It means they'll be done by working with governments that tend not to be as committed to these experiments compared to the way that NGOs treat them.
Running a larger scale evaluation is going to take more of some resources, more time, more money. I think we would probably say more emotional stamina, because there's a lot of risk involved. And so that's something to manage and be wise about. We talk a bit about that. But we also think that there is, in some sense, a really big untapped opportunity to do more of this style of work. And the reason is that there are enormous programs rolling out all the time, many of which have very little evidence behind them. And if we can convince the people implementing these programs to randomize those rollouts, as we've been able to do in some cases, we get the opportunity to learn about the impacts they're having at the scale that we actually care about. And I think that's a really exciting opportunity that we haven't fully exploited yet. So one interesting thing about that, by the way, is that it can take a bit of a mindset shift to do that style of work. And I've found this when I've spoken with the folks on our team. And what I mean by that is that when we test things at a small scale, things that aren't already getting funded in a big way, what we're really looking for is something that's going to work better than expected, right? We're looking for positive surprises that we can then take and scale up. And that's great. It's obviously really exciting when you find those things. The interesting thing is when you test big things, things that are already getting tons of funding, sometimes the wins are the opposite, right? It's finding things that don't work or things that have negative side effects that we didn't anticipate. And you can actually say, well, let's save that money and spend it on something else.
So let me just add to that, Tim, because I think, you know, you said something that does this mean that fewer evaluations would be done? And I just want to say that I don't see that at all. And we'll talk a little bit more about this. But the budgets for these studies are not necessarily that much bigger. And like Paul just said, these are programs that the governments are often doing anyway. So if you go back to our Indonesia study, I mean, by far the most expensive thing there was the doubling of teacher pay. And this was something the governments were doing anyway. So in that sense, it doesn't feel like there's a trade-off here, because all you're doing is saying there's an insane amount of money being spent at scale that is not being studied. And just to kind of reiterate what Paul said, that's really an untapped opportunity for more high-quality studies, rather than kind of saying we want to crowd out the small ones and just add a few big ones.
Spillover effects can be hard to understand. This isn't just a question of scale, is it? It's also how you design the experiment.
Yeah, so it is a question of scale in the sense that any program, if it were to be truly scaled up, would then generate spillovers of multiple sorts. I mean, there's kind of the mechanical spillovers in an epidemiological sense that matters for, say, like a deworming program. And then there's broader economic spillovers in terms of how your intervention affects markets, affects the behavior of other people in the economy. And, you know, so the good news here is that there is a range at which one could design studies that capture these spillovers. And we discussed this in the paper, starting with the deworming example, where, for example, randomizing at the individual level might give you the wrong results because you're not accounting for the fact that the control group benefits when the treatment group has a lower infection rate. And that was famously shown in this Econometrica paper by Michael Kramer and Ted Miguel. Then you could look at spillovers at a more intermediate level, say like a village, where we've got this paper studying school choice and school vouchers, where one open concern has been that if there are kids who win vouchers and go to private schools, does that lead to negative spillovers on the kids who are in the private schools to begin with, or on the kids left behind in the public schools? And so that was something that was addressed by randomizing at a market level. And this is a flavor of work that's now being done in many, many other settings as well. And then the final one, which is when you want to start looking at labor markets more broadly, is the example of the general equilibrium paper that Paul and I did, along with Sandeep Suktankar, where we worked with the government to randomize an intervention that reduce corruption and improved implementation of a public employment program at the level of an entire sub-district. And that was then something that allowed us to also look at the effects on market wages and employment. And that's another sense in which experimenting at scale can give you insights on parts of the economy that would move and respond to a treatment that you wouldn't if, in fact, you were randomizing at a smaller scale. So just to give you some numbers, if you were to evaluate the public employment program by randomizing at the individual level, I think we estimate that you'd miss this about 90% of the effects relative to doing this at the market level.
Are you saying that for RCTs, there's a cutoff point for scale? If they're smaller than that, then there's really no point in doing them.
Certainly not. And I'm glad you asked, because we want to be very clear that that's not what we're saying. And, you know, as we say in the paper, you want to have a mix, you want to have diversity. There's a very nice companion paper in the same edition talking about examples in which you might want to go from something small to something big and evaluate at each step along the way. And so I think we certainly agree with that. But we also think that when we do small scale evaluations, there are ways in which we can share more information with each other that are helpful when we want to think about how those interventions might then scale. And so to give a few examples of those, it could be routine in RCTs to show tables that compare the sample or the frame to some broader population of interest. So we can think about how similar, how representative is this likely to be. That could be as routine as the tables that we all produce that show internal balance, right? Or the treatment and control groups similar. We think that you could take the behavioral impacts that we estimate in these studies and think about how to combine them with price elasticities that we get from elsewhere. So for example, if we see that an intervention raises labor supply by 5%, we can think about, if everybody's labor supply went up by 5%, what do we know about what would likely happen to wages, and how would that change our conclusion? And I think that in terms of scalability of the intervention itself, there are some really low-hanging fruit. You know, thinking about what are the scarce inputs that would be required to do this at a larger scale? What does the cost structure look like? Can we give people enough detail on the cost structure for people to form views on how unit costs are likely to change with scale? So these are all things that we typically know something about. It's just not the norm yet to include that information in the papers, and I think that would be really helpful.
You guys know from experience how difficult it is to organize these evaluations. Are you being realistic when you call for researchers to scale up because the process just might become completely unmanageable?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so I think, you know, there's two or three answers to that. I think, the first is that we're hardly the first to do these things. I mean, there's been many examples of people managing successfully to run experiments that are large on at least some of the dimensions that we outlined. So going back to the original Progressa experiments, the most famous ones, I mean, these were implemented pretty much the way the whole program was scaled up. So the unit of randomization may not have been as large, but the implementation protocol looked exactly like what a scaled up version would look like. There's some very nice studies in Indonesia on different kinds of targeting of anti-poverty programs by Ben Olken, Rima Hanna, Abhijit Banerjee, and co-authors. There's the work we talked about doubling teacher salaries in Indonesia. There's some very nice work in Pakistan that Asim Khwaja and others have done in multiple sectors with tax collectors with different interventions in terms of school markets. So I think the point with all of this is that people have shown that this can be done. It's also important to highlight and repeat something that Paul said, which is, I don't think we're saying that all experiments need to be bigger. There's been a lot of ink spilt on the methodology wars between the people who claim that anything that's not RCT is, you know, not as credible, and others on the other extreme saying that, oh, you know, RCTs are not privileged and here are all of these problems. I think our goal in writing this paper was to diffuse this tension a little bit and focus on how we can make progress. And we think one very concrete way in which such progress can be made is doing these experiments at a larger scale, which address many of these limitations. So coming back to, are we being realistic? I think there's two ways to think about why this is realistic. One, many people have done this. And second is that our experience in working with governments suggests that many of the ways in which we want experiments to be bigger are fully consistent with what the governments want. So in none of my interactions with government have I ever faced pushback in terms of wanting to do this in representative samples, because governments are in fact very happy to see things done in all parts of the country or all parts of the state, partly because they understand that there's variability across context and they would like to see results that are generalizable. They want the implementation to mimic the scaled up programs. And while the spillovers might be a little bit more of an academic concern than the policy one, in practice, the government will often want the unit of implementation to be at an administrative unit, that is a logical unit of governance, which often will give us the scale to get at some of these spillover effects. Our point is that it's doable. We've done it many, many times, and many others have done it too.
Are there any practical trade-offs that can be made when we design an experiment that makes it easier to scale up?
Tim, as Karthik said, there are some cases where scale is cheap and we should do it. And it's not that hard. You know, as Karthik said, having a sample of 1,000 people can be representative of 1,000 people, or it could be representative of a million people or 10 million people, right? And it's still going to cost about the same. So in some cases like that, I think there are no trade-offs. I think the biggest thing in our work that we found is that it takes some organizational capacity to do this kind of work, and that takes time to build. And often that's because you have to be ready to react when an opportunity comes along. You know, a new initiative gets announced, it's going to get rolled out. There's a short window of opportunity when you can negotiate an agreement to evaluate it, and you have to be ready to say, yes, we're in. And so that means having the team ready, and it means having the funding ready and being able to go quickly. And that's hard, right? And it doesn't work very well in a world where projects are organized and funded around the individual project as opposed to around larger initiatives. And with a larger initiative, what we found is that you can build those things up over time. You have stronger incentives to invest in training your team. Things that we find very rewarding as well, I think, being able to say somebody's going to be with us for 4 years as part of a larger team. We can actually invest the effort in training them and building culture and these sorts of things. So I do think that it's important to do more of this work, to be able to do more of it designed around initiatives as opposed to around projects. And I think that for that to happen, more funders have to be willing to fund initiatives as opposed to individual projects. And we've been very fortunate to work with funders who buy that and have taken that approach, but it's still relatively rare.
You've been around the block a few times, but for listeners who are just starting out on their careers, do you have any practical advice on how to organize a large-scale field experiment like this?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing to highlight, of course, is that this is by no means the only way to do research. There are many, many, many ways of doing incredibly high quality PhD research. And so I think it's important, first and foremost, to not imply to young researchers that if you cannot do an RCT at scale, or if you cannot do an RCT, that you can't be doing high quality work in development economics. I think there's a very broad portfolio of how people can do successful research. I think conditional on then wanting to do experimental research, the question is it harder to do things at scale? And of course, there's some challenges. But I think my broad advice is just to relay what my own advisor told me, which is what matters in this business is being passionate about what you do. And then there's going to be people who intrinsically value being at scale. And I think the point of our piece is to say, listen, like, you shouldn't be scared, like, that this is not doable. It's in fact doable. So concretely speaking, I think the people who manage to do this kind of work successfully, even as PhD students, are people who've had some private sector experience. The two or three things that you get from that are a project management skills, which is not something that's usually taught to PhD students. And you also get client skills in terms of just putting yourself in the shoes of your partner and thinking about how you would make a compelling value proposition to funders, to partners, to implementers. So I think in terms of skills that people would want to build if they want to do this kind of work, I think having some private sector sensibility, or just some, it doesn't even have to be private sector, I would just say some client sensibility, I think would be quite useful. And then I think there's the ways you learn this. For a lot of us, there is just a genuine learning by doing an apprenticeship. Is you learn by being a research assistant on a larger project, either before grad school or in the first couple of years in your PhD. You just kind of learn the ropes and see how seniors do this. So in that sense, I think we're starting to resemble the natural sciences a little bit more, where usually the PhD training is about giving you the technical skills and the postdoc training is about giving you the managerial skills of running a lab and writing the grants and managing the research enterprise, so to speak. And so as the frontier of knowledge gets more and more advanced, and as you need more teams with more complementary skills to deliver high quality work, there might be multiple phases of training where people pick up different sets of these skills. But I think the broader message for younger researchers is that, A, this is doable, it's valuable, it's valued by funders, by governments. And if you care about doing work that's rigorous and relevant, there is certainly a way here to plan your training and be part of projects and teams that will let you do that kind of work.
Kartik and Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
If you want to know more about this, our interviewees are the authors of an article called Experimentation at Scale that was published in 2017 in the Journal of Economic Perspectives. This has been a VoxDev Talk. You can find others in the series at voxdev.org. And now all our VoxDev Talks are available on the major podcast platforms.